and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. My name is Mark Williams, speaking to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. My guest today is Jonathan Strachan, Director of Ship Design and Engineering at Holder Limited. Holder is a maritime design and consultancy company established back in the 1840s by the Holder family, though it is now owned by its employees. In the 19th and 20th centuries, Holder was a ship owner and operator, passing through owners Furnaswithy and Orient overseas. In the 1970s, Holder was a market leader in the UK's burgeoning North Sea subsea sector. And back in 1987, Holder Limited was formed as an independent business offering design and engineering services, and this is the main line of business today. As Holder's Director of Ship Design and Engineering, Jonathan leads on new buildings and vessel conversions. He specialises in the energy transition, and his recent work features fuel-efficient designs, LNG fuels and carbon capture. Jonathan joined Holder in 2013, having previously worked at ABS Consulting, Carnival Corporation and Camel Laird, as well as a five-year stint at Lloyd's Register after graduating with a master's degree in marine technology at the Newcastle University. So Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you.
So I was thinking, it must be the most exciting time in many years, possibly decades, to be a naval architect, to be in that maritime space, not just ships, with so many challenges creating so many opportunities for new designs. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely, Mark. I mean, just taking a few little snapshots, really. For example, just including three of the vessels we designed recently using diesel electric. So that's the Sir David Attenborough, the White Link vessel, the Victoria of White. Both of those are diesel electric, but we incorporated energy storage in them. So they've got batteries to improve the efficiency of the vessel. And then we've incorporating that into the design of the new ferry for the Isle of Man. So that's one thing, but there's plenty of other things going on as well. There's LNG as a fuel, which we recently incorporated into one of our ferry designs. There's all the scrubber options or exhaust treatment scrubbers, SCRs and carbon capture, which we'll probably talk about later. But then there's all the novel fuels, methanol, ammonia and hydrogen, and hydrogen in whichever form you want to take it. So that's either liquid hydrogen or compressed hydrogen, or we've done a recent study on liquid organic hydrogen carriers where the hydrogen is chemically bonded into a hydrocarbon and then extracted and used. So all of those aimed at reducing emissions, but then there's all the opportunities that come from improving the efficiency of your hull form using computational fluid dynamics optimization tools. And we've been integrating those into our recent designs of hull forms. We're recently going through that stage at the moment for the two vessels we're designing for Marine Scotland. One of them's a research vessel and one of them's an intervention vessel. But then you've got all the other options for propeller design as well. If you want to reduce the underwater noise from your propeller, so if you've got a research vessel that's going into sensitive areas and wants to actually follow some of the underwater animals and things, then you need a quiet propeller, but also to make sure that it doesn't interfere with your sensors. And then there's all the other efficiency measures that you can incorporate onto the propulsion. So that's propeller boss cap fins, Mewis ducts, and air lubrication. We're assisting Silverstream with a number of refits for fitting the air lubrication system. So that's going on as well. And then apart from all of that, you have the option of fitting Flettner rotors, kites, or actual sails to your bulk carriers. And then that's one side, and then you can extend it even further to what you're going to do to incorporate automation in today's day and age. The ferry that I just mentioned earlier, the White Link ferry, incorporates an automatic mooring system from a Cavotec tech called the MoorMaster, and that can reduce the turnaround time for that ferry and therefore reduce overall its requirement to its top speed to actually maintain its schedule, and therefore reduce its emissions as well. And then moving on, you've got all the options with automation that's coming, and that's automation that's designed into the vessel. And we've got clients that are interested in, at the moment, going for a minimum crew and also incorporating as much autonomy as they possibly can, kind of ready for the future where autonomy is going to come in and they can put some of those crew on shore. And then there's all the options for taking on and recovering autonomous vehicles as well, which is a whole different subject.
Just going back to those hydrodynamic elements you mentioned, propeller bosses, Mewis ducts, air lubrication and so on. For the uninitiated, these are all ways, aren't they, of gaining efficiency and shaving a few percent off fuel consumption.
Yeah, absolutely. The important thing is to note is that, I don't know, one might take off 2%, another might take off 3%, but they aren't necessarily cumulative. So you might make some efficiencies by improving the flow into your propeller with a Mewis duct, but you wouldn't necessarily carry on and gain the full efficiency out of the propeller boss cap if you put them all together. You need to analyze them as a whole, which again is interesting for us naval architects to incorporate these analyses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it begs the question. Some of these things are retrofittable, but it's a ship-by-ship decision, isn't it? As each ship is a bespoke project rather than a production line product.
Yeah, I'd agree entirely with that. I mean, it's even if you had a series of sister vessels and you thought, well, actually, I can what I fit to one, I can fit to all the others. You've got to just make sure that actually on the route you're fitting it on the range of drafts you're going to be operating at and the speed you're going to be operating at, it actually works for you. And quite often some of these elements, they're quite trim sensitive as well. So you've got to look at your ship design, but also how you're operating it to make sure it actually does what you expect it to or does what it says on the tin, kind of thing.
Most ship owners, I think, would pride themselves on their technical knowledge and competence. Managing costs is what they can do. You can't manage freight rates. Well, you can with FFAs and time charters, I suppose, but the freight market goes up and down regardless of what individual ship operators do. They're a consequence of the mass supply and demand balance. But they can, individual ship owners can manage their costs, and then that means managing the ships on the technical side. So I imagine that despite that, there's quite a lot of hand-holding you still have to do with new technology. So what sort of research and guidance do you offer to ship owners in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, we've done quite a few of these studies now for a number of owners, SOV owners, tanker owners, ferry operators, and ro-ro operators, to name a few. And quite often they know their vessel very well, but I think it's finding the time to analyze some of these alternatives in sufficient detail that we can really help them get a direction. And we've done it enough times now that we've got some of our own in-house tools that we can quickly apply. So for example, the owner may be thinking about installing batteries. Well, we have a tool that can determine based on the operating profile of the vessel quite quickly whether those are any use to you at all. So whether you have enough transient loads to make it worthwhile installing batteries or not, or whether all you're doing is increasing the weight of your ship and actually overall therefore increasing displacement and so on and so forth. So I think we can help. I think it's a case of helping them based on their information that they know about their ship.
Thinking about new buildings, we talked about the energy transition at the introduction, and it's what ship energy is all about, and it's a specialism of yours. So to what degree do you have to try to future-proof your designs, being aware of the direction of travel, of environmental regulations and ambitions, or can you only work within the regulatory limits we have today?
No, increasingly clients are looking for really being very ambitious, some of them. Some of them have ambitions to have, zero carbon vessels. And we're looking into studies to see how best that can be achieved, either going for one of the alternative fuels, methanol or ammonia, or probably more straightforwardly, I suppose, in the, if you want to do something quicker, would be HVO or one of those other alternative fuels that are based on, a kind of green diesel, should we say. Yeah, I mean, we are working on quite a few of these options for them. And, you know, the standard, not standard, none of this is standard, but there are a few kind of front runners and there's a few outliers, and we're looking at them all to see which ones actually map best to that specific ship. So some of it's quite straightforward. If you have a ferry that's going a short route, then you might be able to get batteries to work for you. Or if you have an SOV that can recharge in the wind turbine field, then that's possible. But actually, if you have a longer range, then batteries quickly become, you know, I think, impossible, really. So you're looking at one of the alternatives, be it, you know, methanol, ammonia, hydrogen, biofuels, like I said earlier, HVO, that kind of thing. But also we're looking at carbon capture as well. You know, we've got a couple of companies that we know of that can produce cryogenic carbon capture systems. And that can mean that there is a chance to carry on using your existing engines, you know, an existing fuel.
Carbon capture means you can burn fuel oil, scrub carbon dioxide from the emissions on a ship, and then reuse the carbon potentially to create synthetic fuels, or you can put the carbon away somewhere in a carbon sink, and therefore not allowing it to be emitted to the atmosphere.
Yeah, and then it would be stored on board as a liquid, and then you know we have to work out the logistics of debunkering it back to where you got it from. But then it can be used in the process of making green methanol or other fuels. Yeah.
Yeah, I've mused in the past about the concept of large seagoing power to X platforms using wind, wave and solar power to electrolyze seawater and produce hydrogen. That hydrogen can then be combined with captured carbon discharged from ships onto the platform. The hydrogen and carbon can then be combined to create synthetic fuels, gas, oil, methanol or methane. So these vast floating power to X platforms could be big bunkering stations out at sea, because one thing we do know is that ships potentially won't be able to sail as far as they do now on the new alternative fuels if they have bunker space the same as they do now, because those alternative fuels have less energy density than fuel oil. So they'll either have to sacrifice cargo space or perhaps bunker more frequently as a better alternative.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, exactly that. And there's going to be impacts on the arrangement of the vessel, you know, in terms of, you know, needing two or three times the volume for the actual tankage on board. Yeah, and then there's the safety aspects of the alternative fuels. Ammonia is a running point. I mean, it's a hazardous chemical. We know that. There's questions. I think they're trialling it at the moment, but there's questions as to whether a gas engine, you potentially have methane slip, and for ammonia engine, there is potential for ammonia slip. Now, with ammonia being more of a hazardous chemical, there will be a debate, I'm sure, as to how much of that is going into the atmosphere and whether it's noticeable or hazardous to the people on board.
Yes, having just got Tier 3 engines sorted out to remove oxides of nitrogen, shipping would potentially, with ammonia fuel, be having to work on another system to avoid all the NOx emissions from the ammonia fuel in the engines.
Nitrous oxide is, as I understand it, is quite a powerful greenhouse gas in itself.
Yeah, as well as being hazardous to health for asthma sufferers, for instance. Yeah. So what would you say as a naval architect are the biggest constraints you and your clients face when working on a new building or conversions? Is it a lack of ship finance or the regulations or fuel technology? Or
from what I can see from from the work that we've been doing with our clients is that it depends on what you're looking at. So if you're looking at fitting batteries to a to a diesel electric vessel to reduce your emissions that way, then I don't think the constraints are really that pressing. If you're looking to go methanol ready or ammonia ready, then I think getting the green ammonia or green methanol is definitely a constraint in the area where you're working or where the vessel will be operating. And then there's, for ammonia, there is the question of actually getting the regulations set up and in place. Because I know that ammonia, you know, we have many years of experience of carrying ammonia around the world, but I don't know of any rules and regs for how to burn it at the moment. So that needs to be developed. And then with hydrogen, again, I think it's probably just trying to get the technology to a level where it's ready is probably the constraint in my view. And then following all of that, the regulation as well.
Given all those constraints, the infrastructure for alternative fuels has to be built. The fuels aren't available in anything like the volumes required. For instance, shipping would require something like 3 to 4 times total current ammonia production worldwide. I do sometimes wonder why we don't spend the money on the synthetic fuels, although they're supposed to be the most expensive route to the IMO's targets. But they can make use of the infrastructure and engine technology we already have, so you don't have to reinvent that. It's perhaps therefore not going to be any more expensive, maybe, and would create a circular economy for the carbon that shipping emits.
Yeah, I think I definitely think that's something that we're keen to investigate. You know, methanol as a fuel tied in with carbon capture on board the vessel, and then you can return the carbon dioxide back to the plant from whence you got it, and then that can be combined with hydrogen to actually make synthetic or green methanol. I think that certainly is an option. Yeah.
So a lot of that spend is going to have to take place before you can guide your customers on what's the most economical and long-lasting decision for them for each vessel type.
I think as has been undertaken up until now with LNG ready, you have the option to go down, say, a methanol ready. So you have engines that are capable of burning the methanol. You have the space that's set up within the vessel ready for that as a fuel. And I don't think, I mean, although you need more space for it than you would for heavy fuel oil, it's not that tricky to find the location, because my understanding is you can put it against the bottom shell of the vessel. So you could use some, you know, you could use some double bottom tanks. So, yeah, I think actually getting some of these clients to back a couple of horses. So say, well, I'm going to go down, you know, MGO at the moment or LNG, but actually in the future I'm ready to go down to methanol when that infrastructure's there and available.
Let's think again about retrofits rather than new buildings. On conversions in particular, for instance, to meet EEXI requirements, do you have to consider the CapEx-OpEx balance, and how hard or easy is it to work out the CapEx costs for all these upgrades?
Definitely. I mean, that needs to be considered, you know, and the way we would help an owner to do that is by, you know, when you've got to the point where we've helped them decide on which route they want to go down, and we do look at the options, and when we're doing the selection of the options, we kind of have a comparison of the relative costs of CapEx of them. And then once we've actually selected, then you put together a full spec for that refit or that modification. And then, you know, you can actually then get a really good idea from shipyards quoting for the modifications, what the actual CapEx is for that before you make a decision. I think it definitely needs to be done. I mean, there's some recent work that we've done. We did a bit of analysis on the fleets around Europe of, say, bulk carriers, tankers and container ships. And our view is that about 67% of the fleet need to do something to comply with EEXI requirements. And actually, when you analyse it, the majority of them are already going about 2 knots slower than their design speed. When you put a cube law through curve through that, that equates to enough of a power reduction to actually comply for the majority of those vessels, which in our, from our analysis, so the majority of them could be dealt with a power limiting device. And then you've got about 6-7% that need to do something more drastic. So that is either further modifications or alternatively, you know, that CapEx decision can be deciding whether to go ahead and make the modifications or to take some other more drastic actions with the vessel. I, my view with the power limiting device is that actually it might be a bit of a missed opportunity if you're just going to permanently run the vessel slower. Then you should look at what the options are for a new propeller, what the options are for a different bulb, because you can get quite a lot more out of it if you design it for that new speed. But then again, that all has to go into the CapEx and the OpEx review.
There's a point at which ship owners might say, I'm not going to throw good money after bad. And given that scrap prices this year have been about $500 per ton, come down a wee bit recently, but we're in that range. A ship owner has to consider that income that you can get from selling the ship for scrap today versus the possible income from trading the ship for the next few years after the maintenance and repair spend. And for some ships, the most economic option will be to scrap, won't it?
Yeah, exactly. I can see that. And that does, I suppose that's the natural cycle of it. And that's what the plan is for the regulation, really. Modify some ships, scrap others.
I suppose that the shipyards that have survived the new building market downturn will be looking forward to a potential tsunami of new buildings using these new technologies. It reminds me of the single hull tanker phase out in the 2000s. Tanker owners waited until 2007 pretty much and then ordered nearly 800 double hull tankers in that year, all for delivery before 2010, or nearly all. And most of them delivered, therefore, after the global financial crisis struck in 2008. Only to be worth less than their mortgageable value in really many cases. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. We're running out of time, so perhaps we'll wrap it up there. But thank you to you for coming in.
No, thank you, Mark.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And I hope that's been of interest to you all today. And we look forward to welcoming you to another podcast very soon. Thanks and goodbye.